How are you?
We'll call the Senate Environmental Natural Resource Committee to order. The date is January 24th, 2012. This being our first meeting of this session. Welcome, everybody. Today we have just a couple things on the agenda, and I think we're all certainly thinking about going from here to a banquet tonight, so we'd like to get done in a timely fashion. I see no reason why we can't be. We're going to start out first with the confirmation of DNR Commissioner Tom Landwehr. So Mr. Landwehr would come forward, and we'll start out with some opening statements, Commissioner, and at that point we'll have some questions from the members if they have some. But members, any questions of the process from this point forward? Okay, Mr. Landwehr, Commissioner, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Tom Landwehr. I'm currently the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and here today for my confirmation hearing. I have never been through this before, and Mr. Chairman, my understanding is you've not been through this in that position before either, so I'm going to kind of wing it here a little bit. I thought what I would do is tell you a little bit about my background, tell you a little bit about what I see for the Department of Natural Resources, and then tell you a little bit about some of the big issues that I see in front of us that we'll be dealing with. So for starters, I'm a lifelong Minnesotan. I was born in Mankato. I've lived in Minnesota my whole life. I got a bachelor's and a master's degree in wildlife management from the University of Minnesota in the early to mid-80s. Subsequently went on and got a master's in business administration from the University of Minnesota in early 2000s with a finance concentration. The reason I did is because I felt like I had a good grasp of the biological world in my education, but felt like it was important if I was going to go into management positions to have a better understanding of finance and strategic planning and administration and supervision and so on. So I've had the pleasure of getting familiar with the University of Minnesota and with getting familiar with the staff over there. I started working for the Department of Natural Resources back in 1981. I worked as a wildlife biologist for the Department of Natural Resources up until 1999. I served in a number of field roles, mostly in southern Minnesota, primarily working with private landowners, with farmers, and ultimately moved into the St. Paul office where my specialty was wetlands and waterfowl, which is a keen area of interest for me. As a result of that work, I became familiar with some of the folks in the nonprofit world, Ducks Unlimited in particular. And in 1999, Ducks Unlimited hired me to be their conservation director for Minnesota and Iowa. So from 1999 to 2003, I worked for Ducks Unlimited in Minnesota and Iowa. And in 2003, I was hired by the Nature Conservancy to be the conservation director in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. So from 2003 until last January, I was the assistant state director for TNC in the three states. Of course, last January, Governor selected me as a commissioner. I didn't know the governor before that, but I appreciated his priorities for state government and for the department, and I was honored to have that position. In addition to my professional training and experience, I've also been an elected official. I served for two terms on the Shoreview City Council. I worked had a seat as a member, a board member of a water management organization, the Grass Lake Water Management Organization in the North Metro. And I am currently adjunct faculty at the University of Minnesota. I teach a wetlands conservation class each year at the university. So I've had some additional experience beyond that professional work. I think it's important for a commissioner to have really firsthand knowledge of the constituency and the resource issues that the people of Minnesota experience. To that end, I'm a very avid hunter and angler. I hunt birds and deer and turkeys, and I fish for trout and walleyes and crappies as much as I can. I believe it's important to get children involved, so I've taken a number of kids, my own included, through firearm safety training and through some of the youth hunting opportunities. I really enjoy camping. I canoe, I boat, I pick wild rice in Minnesota, and I think because most of what I do is on public lands, I think I am kind of the Joe Sixpack outdoor user that I think really is what the majority of our Minnesota constituency looks like. So that's a little bit about my history. I have been honored for the last year to serve as the commissioner of the DNR, and I had several objectives when I came on as commissioner for the department. Of course, the governor had three priorities. That was to improve Minnesota for jobs. His second was to make sure that government works for Minnesotans, and the third was to be as efficient as possible. And we really have tried to take some major strides in all those areas over the last year. I think one of my first actions was to appoint a senior managers team for the department, the 14 or so appointed positions within the department. And I was very committed to making sure we had a diverse team that was also very responsive to the constituency, and spent a good amount of effort doing outreach to our many constituencies around the state. So we have one of my first marching orders from my boss was to get up to Kitson and Roseau County, and we flew up and had a couple of meetings up there, and we've been traveling around the state ever since. I was up in Cloquet and Duluth last week visiting a couple of mills, the Sappy paper mill in Cloquet and the Louisiana Pacific sideboard mill in Two Harbors, and really I'm trying to get out. We've done Iron Range tours. We've done a couple of tours of northwestern Minnesota and several events in southeast and southwest Minnesota. So I believe it's very important for us to get out, be in touch with the people of Minnesota and hear what their concerns are. And I think to that end, my one of my principal tasks since I've been at the department is really trying to improve relationships with many key constituencies around the state. So we have worked very diligently, especially in northwest Minnesota, to repair some relationships, to rebuild some bridges in northwest Minnesota, and make sure people understand that it's our job to work with local communities, not to be working against them. So bottom line, I see that my job as a commissioner is really to be the chief steward of our public resources and really balance what I see is the long-term sustainability that we need for future generations of Minnesotans, as well as providing for the current uses of those resources for economic, recreational, and environmental purposes as well. Going forward, I think it's going to be a key point of my administration that we will continue to work on outreach and accessibility. We have tried to foster that internally as well as externally. We're trying to make sure all of the staff know where we need to be as a department, and make sure that they convey the same sentiments out to the field. So we go where problems are, and also go where they're not. Make sure that we don't have problems developing in the future. I think as we look at the horizon, some of the key issues that are facing the department. One of them is recruitment. We have seen declining participation in outdoor recreation, whether it's hunting and fishing or camping or any number of outdoor activities. We're seeing declining numbers of people interested in careers in forest products industry and in mining. And we need to find ways to bring people into getting active in the outdoors. So we've been focusing on that, working with some of the nonprofits to help get not just kids, but adults, new adults involved in some of these outdoor activities as well. Of course, the biggest issue that we think is facing us today is just invasive species and aquatic invasive species in particular. We've all talked about zebra mussels and silver carp in particular as two of our looming threats right now. And we don't have a complete toolbox to address those. We're working to expand the toolbox we've got and find additional ways to both deter the spread of these animals as well as to ultimately find some silver bullet that we can use to eliminate them once they have become infested. It is going to be a pivotal year for grasslands in Minnesota. Everybody knows about the Conservation Reserve Program. The map I saw today suggests that we have 238,000 acres of CRP contracts expiring this year. Huge number out of our roughly 1.3 million acres. And given the price of commodities and the relatively modest rental rates that CRP is paying, likely that we will see a large percentage of that 238,000 acres not be re-enrolled. And that has a lot of implications. It's not just that it's important for pheasants and ducks. It's important for water quality and soil quality and groundwater quality. So I think we, as a state, need to figure out how we can work with the federal government to ensure that we do have grasslands going forward, that landowners are not penalized for having grasslands, and that we can sustain a viable agricultural economy with grasslands present. We have some looming threats with the forest products industry. We've been through the biggest downturn in a long time in the forest products industry with the collapse of the housing market, the global challenges we face in the paper markets. I have been hearing some promising impressions from some of the mill operators that they believe maybe we've hit the bottom and things are starting to look up a little bit. But it really is critical for us as a state to make sure that we retain these industries, not just because of the jobs they support and the local economies they support, which of themselves are most important, but because they also are the managers of our forests. The state has 5 million acres of state forests managed for the benefit of citizens of Minnesota, and we need a healthy forest products industry to do the management by virtue of timber cutting and thinning and regeneration in order to keep those forest industries. So it is incumbent on us to make sure that we work to maintain that forest products industry. And finally, I want to say that in the department, the model that I want our folks to be thinking of is what we call conservation that works. You know, conservation is something that is good in and of itself in my mind, but unless it works for the people of Minnesota and works in truly efficiently and effectively in conserving things, it's not going to be viable in the long term. We have to ensure that people in communities that are affected by conservation understand that there's value to them in that conservation. We need to make sure that the limited dollars that we're spending are effective in achieving the conservation goals that we're setting out. And we just need to make sure that we have the support of the constituency, which ultimately will be the support of you all for our conservation programs. So just in conclusion, I want to acknowledge, I recognize the authority that the commissioner has, both by virtue of statutes and by virtue of funding, comes from you all, and I want to work very closely with you all as we look towards the future in implementing conservation in Minnesota. I'm a firm believer in listening, and I recognize that I don't learn anything by talking. I learn by listening. We may not always agree on things, but I know everybody's opinion is as legitimate as mine, and we will move forward doing what we think is the best for Minnesota. I'm committed to Minnesota and sustainability. I was asked why I wanted this job by an outdoor reporter a year ago, and upon very brief reflection, it was, you know, I love Minnesota. I love the state. I love the natural resources in literally every corner of this state. I've been in every corner of the state, even before I had the job as commissioner, experiencing those resources. And I want them to be there for my kids and your kids and future generations of Minnesota, because I think it's all part of who we are. So, Mr. Chairman, committee members, with that, I would end my remarks. I appreciate your support. I'd be honored to answer any questions, and thank you very much for having me here today.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, for those opening remarks. Any questions from the committees? Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Landwehr, I've got to say, you forgot that you've also been mountain bike riding in the Cuyuna mountain bike trails near Crosby.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I try to blank that out because I came that close to dying, and it was, I could just see myself flying off into an ore pit, you know, with a 200-foot bottom, and it was not a pretty picture.
We had the opportunity with Senator Gazelka and Carlson. I think Carlson was with that one that day we were over there, and wow, I'm telling you, that mountain biking is an extreme sport.
It makes one realize why God invented Mountain Dew.
thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Commissioner, I do have some questions relating to the mining industry. I don't think you addressed that, and just two or three, but I want to have a sense of where you are, where the governor is. The governor was up in Brainerd maybe half a year ago for a job summit, and he talked about a mining coordinator. Where are we at in this process? Are you behind that? Do you support that? I'll have about three questions, but that's the first one.
Commissioner.
Very good. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the governor, as I mentioned at the beginning, has declared that jobs are going to be an important part of his administration, and by virtue of taking this job, it is also one of my primary considerations. The governor and several of the agencies soon formed a mining sub-cabinet, so we have a regular meeting now between several cabinet-level appointees, the PCA, the Department of Economic Development, RRRB and DNR are key in there. And the purpose is to make sure that we have an environment in which mining feels welcome. So we are meeting regularly. We had a meeting, I believe, last week and had a representative from, I believe it was Mesabi Nugget, came in and gave us a presentation. We want to make sure two things. Let me back up a little bit. Minnesota is extraordinarily rich in terms of our iron ore capacity as well as the non-ferrous capacity. We've got a long, rich tradition of iron ore mining. The iron ore industry right now is going gangbusters. They're doing a lot of expansion up on the range. And people have, you know, people of Minnesota have accepted iron ore mining as one of our fundamental economic drivers in northeast Minnesota. We have an unknown path forward with non-ferrous mining, and obviously we're proceeding very cautiously on that and making sure that we are we're going to have sustainable operations. But I believe we can. I think we are working with the mining companies, the non-ferrous companies, Polymet in particular, to make sure that as we go through the environmental impact statement process, that at the end of that, they have shown us, the regulators, that they have an operation that can meet statutory standards and still be economically viable. So I apologize for rambling here a little bit, Senator, but bottom line is the governor supports jobs, supports mining. The state statutes declare that the commissioner shall promote exploration and extraction of minerals, so I am statutorily obligated to do that, and we have been taking many, many steps in order to make sure that our permitting process facilitates that mining and still ensures the sustainability of our natural environment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'll try to get it down to one more question because I appreciate the answer you gave. Having graduated from Virginia, Minnesota, I'm not there now, but when they say we could have upwards of 10,000 new jobs around that whole industry, I want to do everything we can to help that area. It just makes some sense. One of the things that has come up in the news lately is surface rights versus people with mineral rights. In the past, it seemed to be a given that people understood that, you know, mineral rights were not necessarily theirs. But I'm just wondering, that's been in the news. Where are you at on that issue? Where is it at today?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. A little background on that. First, the state owns 12 million acres of mineral rights. Recall when the state was granted a bunch of school trust lands and other lands for development of the state. All of those lands had mineral rights associated with them. We have sold most of the school trust lands. We originally had 8 million acres. We now have 2.5 million acres, so we have sold 5.5 million acres of school trust lands. But every time we did, we kept the mineral rights. So think of the mineral rights and the surface rights as two pieces of bread. We sold off the top piece. We retained the bottom piece. We have an enormous acreage of mineral rights across Minnesota. Much of those will never produce anything other than glacial till, but some of those, as we're finding over time, do have valuable mineral deposits associated with them. The way that the state has historically captured those mineral rights is that we have put out bids for vast tracts of these rights and asked the companies to tell us where they would like to explore. When they do, it's a subset of that, then we allow them to explore. If they find something that is worth extraction, then they come to us for a mining permit. So we have the bidding process, we have the exploration process, we have the extraction process. Historically, since the 60s, the state has assembled bid packages that maybe comprise 200,000 acres. That's what we did a year ago, 200,000-acre bid package that we put out to mining companies to find out what they were interested in. They will look through all of that, see what where their interests are, come back to us with a subset of that. So all that 200,000 acres last year, we got 20,000 acres of interest from companies to do exploration. The process is, at that point, is we can accept that bid, but it has to be approved by the State Executive Council of Constitutional Officers. And this is the first year that I'm aware of that we actually ran into a little bit of a snag about that. Part of the snag is that of that 20,000 acres, the state doesn't own the surface rights on, I think, some 13,000 acres of that, some relatively large fraction of those 20,000 acres. The state does not own the surface rights. And I think in part because of the controversy around sulfide mining, people are more sensitized now to mining than they have been historically. If you buy a piece of property, it says right on there whether or not you own the mineral rights. So nobody, in my opinion, has just cause to say, I didn't know this, because that's one of your due diligence things when you buy land. But people in northeast Minnesota who were affected by this felt very threatened by the fact that we were even allowing exploration. The exploration on the 20,000 acres will likely come back with 2,000 acres of interest in additional mining. So it's a winnowing process, but everybody who has severed mineral rights now feels threatened because they're hearing of all the concerns about non-ferrous mining. So long story to bring you to up where we are to date is the last time the Executive Council meeting, which was met, which was in, I believe, November, December, the Executive Council deferred action on those bids, on that bid package, for 6 months. So the governor who chairs that said, we will give you 6 months to go talk to your legislators to see if they want to change the current statutes around severed mineral rights. And the department's not taking any forward action on that, but what would have to happen, of course, is some process for individual landowners to acquire back mineral rights below their surface rights. Right now, the statutory language does not allow that, and we would not generally encourage that because it would really throw a monkey wrench into future mining opportunities in the state.
One last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last year we worked on, or last session, quite a bit of legislation trying to reform the permit process. 150 days, if it went beyond that, they've got a report, and instead of two court appearances, district and appellate, we went straight to the appellate. And the governor agreed with us on that. We all came together, and because we want to speed up the process. We're working on legislation now where if a permit has been submitted that we would like to get a response back within 30 days to say it's substantially complete, just so they know that they're heading the right direction in the process. So it would be mining, but also manufacturing. And I just want to get your perspective on that. Is that something you can work with us on so that we can accomplish?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think the devil's in the details on that one. Let me offer that, we have, I believe it's 8 different permit programs, and not all permits are created equal. We can tell you on the spot whether or not you can get a water appropriation permit, for instance, but a permit to mine is a much more complicated thing. And of course, people hear these long timelines for permitting. Much of that is actually environmental review. It isn't a permitting process till the environmental review is done, the environmental impact statement has been found adequate, and then we go into a permitting process. And sometimes the delay in permitting is actually because we're trying to get to yes. I've heard some regulators in the past say, well, I can give you a decision on a permit today, but it'll be no. If you want to get to yes, it may take a little bit longer. So I think we have to recognize that sometimes the delay in permitting is because we're trying to work with the permittee to get them to a yes. So I'm fully supportive of the process not being the determinator in whether or not a company goes ahead. A permit ought to be granted or denied based on the merits of the permit, and a company ought not have to decide based on how long it's going to take. But I think we need to be aware that we've got several different types of permits, and sometimes taking a little bit longer is a way to get to yes.
Thank you.
Commissioner, well, on that same vein, if I could ask with regards to the Executive Council's decision to delay those leases, and you may have covered this and we probably don't need to waste a whole lot of time on it, but you said you have not taken any forward action on that. What are you willing to do as commissioner to see that this gets resolved during this legislative session?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, well, first off, I think my boss knows that we need to get this resolved. We are working with the governor's office on some language that might clarify the role of the executive council going forward, so that perhaps this would become less of an issue in the future.
Okay. Senator Dames, I have next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Landwehr, in your opening remarks, you alluded to the aquatic invasive species and the seriousness of that issue. And certainly, I think all of Minnesotans are quite concerned about the control and the spread of the aquatic invasive species to the area, rivers and lakes and such, streams and such. Just curious, what are you currently doing and what are your plans to do in the future to ensure that the DNR is providing some policy resources and procedures to address this issue?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The aquatic invasive species, as I mentioned, is a huge issue. And the very first thing we have to consider when we talk about that is that there are two completely different species that we're dealing with right now that really have got the front page news. One is zebra mussels, and the other is Asian carp, or specifically silver carp. And they are both threats, and there are some commonalities in the why they are a threat, but their treatments are completely different. So you granted us last year some additional authorities and some additional funding to deal with invasive species. Much of that is directed at zebra mussels. And those of you that come from lake country know that this is a big concern of many of your lakeshore residents. Zebra mussels, of course, are spread by people and are spread, people traditionally think of them being spread by boats or by bait buckets or, you know, some recreational equipment that you move from an infested lake to a non-infested lake. The challenge that presents is that if people are the cause, people have to be a big part of the solution. And we have 800,000 registered boats in this state. We can't possibly keep an eye on every single boat. So the methodologies that we have developed to deal with the controlling the spread of zebra mussels has to be largely focused on education. So we have to let people know that are operating boats that they are responsible for ensuring their boats are not carrying infestations, that if they aren't diligent in doing their own inspections, that there is enforcement that can, you know, that can penalize them if they're lax in their own monitoring of their own uses. So we have spent a lot of time trying to educate people, putting a structure in place that allows us to do inspections and enforcement. So we have an army of inspectors that goes out to a number of boat ramps every year and helps people understand how to clean their boat. This year, with additional money and additional authorities, we are also purchasing 20 decontamination units. They're going to be, you know, largely educational, again, showing people how to decontaminate and expanding our inspections, our level one, level two inspections, which are different levels of authority that the inspectors have, and stepping up some enforcement. We have gotten to the point, we've been talking about zebra mussels for so long, we know that 18% of people coming off of infested lakes, we've done surveys, 18% coming off of infested lakes do not do basic monitoring to ensure that they don't have invasive species. A huge number, if we knew that 18% of people coming off a lake had an overbag of walleyes, people would be aghast. And we have to make sure that people know that 18% of people may be going to another lake where they're spreading infestation. So it's we're relying on education, inspections, and enforcement for that segment of zebra mussel control. Now, having said that, the last two lakes that we're aware of having been infested happened because a lakeshore owner moved a dock or a boat lift from infested water to an uninfested water without cleaning it, and they brought zebra mussels with them. And so all of the inspections, all of the boat ramp activities we do would not have caught those last two activities. So it goes back to the notion we have to let people know who have, you know, moved things from lake to lake that they have to fundamentally be responsible, give them the tools that they need to inspect and decontaminate, and then make sure that we have the penalties in place to encourage their participation. That's zebra mussels. So that's, you know, that's the old aquatic invasive species we've got. The new aquatic invasive species we've got is a group of carp from originating in Asia, four species, grass carp, bighead carp, black carp, silver carp, that are swimming up the river. They're not being moved by people. They're coming of their own volition. So they're swimming up Mississippi River, and they're getting into our waterways that way. And you all know from the media that we've gotten recently that we have had environmental DNA, eDNA testing that has indicated that silver carp are now in the Twin Cities area, up in the St. Croix, and some concern about above the Coon Rapids Dam. Those species aren't being moved by boats. We have to look at ways we can stop them, either by physical barrier or some other type of barrier. And the only 100% effective barrier that there is on the entire Mississippi River inside of Minnesota is St. Anthony Falls Lock and Dam. The St. Anthony Falls prehistorically was a barrier. There was a 20-foot or better drop, and fish just could not get up that. Of course, it's a lock and dam, and as it's used for commercial navigation, it is now an entryway, or it's an open door for invasive carp. So we're looking at the Coon Rapids Dam, and you all gave us $16 million last year to upgrade the Coon Rapids Dam. We're looking at new deterrent barriers that can be put in place. I just sent a memo over to the governor. I hope to get his concurrence on that. We think there are two other lock and dams where we could put some deterrent barriers in. But there are vast stretches of Minnesota waterways where we don't have a good option to put in place. The Minnesota River, there is not a good option for the Minnesota River. There is no place to put a deterrent barrier. So we know that in addition to barriers, we need to be looking long-term for some other possible solutions. And for that, we need to invest in research. You know, we need to find out how to kill these things. We don't have any way to kill these things, even if we can collect them, which we know we can do with certain barriers and attractants. If we can find ways to eliminate them, that's really what we need in the long term. Research is the only way that will get us there. So two different beasts, two different approaches to control. The question is always going to come up, do we have enough money? And the answer is always no. You know, you will never have enough money. The state will never be able to put enough money into doing a 100% effective invasive species control program because it is fundamentally just exorbitantly expensive. There are 1,500 DNR-owned accesses in the state of Minnesota. There are 1,500 other accesses owned by private individuals, companies, resorts, and so on, or by local units of government. 3,000 accesses. If we wanted to, you know, completely control zebra mussels, you'd have to have somebody on 3,000 accesses 24/7 with all the equipment they would need to decontaminate. So we have to look at reasonable, practical, workable solutions, recognizing that it's not going to be a completely 100% effective.
Thank you.
Commissioner, real quickly on that vein, when you talk about research, you're familiar with the University of Minnesota, Professor Sorensen, and he's done a couple of presentations, and I know you've been there. Just real quickly, are you in favor of that type of research or us looking into that? Because we are certainly looking at that this year.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I absolutely believe that research has to be a critical component of this effort, and the University of Minnesota is certainly as well poised as anybody to do it. Many of these issues have a regional concern. I mean, silver carp are not a Minnesota concern. They are a regional concern, and there are dollars going into via the USGS and the Fish and Wildlife Service to do some research, but some of our problems are Minnesota unique problems, and I do believe that homegrown research is probably the best solution for that. I would offer that I think we have to look very diligently at ensuring this is applied research and not sort of basic research, that we need answers. We don't just need, you know, scientific papers. So let us, if we're devising a local research initiative, make sure that it is outcome-based towards finding solutions to slowing the spread of invasive species.
So it's fair to say that you'd certainly work in conjunction with the University of Minnesota should that become law at the end of this session, hopefully.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would suggest that's imperative that the department and the university be linked in that.
Thank you. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I've got a comment and then a couple of questions. Commissioner, you've done a good job talking about the two largest of the aquatic invasive problems, the zebra mussels and the silver carp. But just a comment, don't forget that there are plant aquatic invasive species also, and I would hope that the department would continue to work with COLAs and other lake associations and other groups to let them do management and whole lake treatments on some of these plants that we also have to continue to control. And you can comment on that if you want. I have two questions, one dealing with land use. I'll do that first, not because I think it's the most important, but because I think it's going to be shorter. The DNR did an inventory of trails in the state. And from my recollection, the purpose of that inventory was to determine areas where there was public support for motorized use, where there was less environmental impacts. Then there would be other areas of the state where there would be more environmental impacts and less public support. And the DNR would have differing degrees of regulation and control and signage and all this, depending upon the result of that inventory. I kind of get the feeling that the inventory was done to determine where all these trails were, and we were just going to put a lot of restrictions on the trails. Could you talk to me just a little bit about what the department is doing with the trail inventory that was done, and if you think the department truly is able to allow some areas to have motorized trails that aren't all signed and closed off. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe the inventory that you're referencing, Senator Scoia, was with respect to identifying suitable motorized uses on state, primarily on state forest lands. And there was a lengthy process that the state engaged in, and the legislature was critical in providing that authority, where state forest by state forest, the existing trails were identified, and compatible trails were signed and opened and so on. And there were two different types of management. One is you could only ride it on certain trails, and other management was you could ride it on all these roads without restriction. And so this is primarily relating to ATVs, to some extent bikes as well, but primarily to ATVs. The process, there was a timeline under which the department tried to operate. The department had to do a first blush designation of trails, and after it was all done, the department realized that there are some trails that end up at dead ends. There are some trails that don't go anywhere, and there are other places where we could use that don't have the environmental impacts that we thought they would have if we treated them appropriately, and also that there are trails that people aren't using. So we're at the point now of engaging in our second round of that OHV planning process to look now at these state forests and look at the trail systems that were created, and completing loops where loops ought to be provided instead of having dead ends, complete loops that could go through. Look at moving alignments. That was one of the things that we didn't consider that first time around, was having a different trail, creating a new trail so that you could have a low impact trail rather than trying to force it on the existing trails and have a serious impact. So now we're going into the second round of planning, and I think we're going to come out with a much better product. We're very engaged with the groups as well. In fact, I just met with the truck group, the four-wheel drive truck group, a couple weeks ago. In fact, Dan Larson was there as well. One of the things I want us as a department to have in mind when we go into these planning processes is let's decide what our goal is for, say, miles of trail. The truck folks are unhappy because they went through all these forest planning exercises only to come to the end and have no trails for trucks. And part of that is because we didn't have a number in mind, a vision in mind of what we ought to be providing for off-road vehicle use as a complete portfolio. So I'm tasking our staff with saying, okay, look, at the end of this planning process, we're going to have X number of miles of off-highway vehicle trails, truck trails. And now we have to figure out where they go so that we know going into this that our planning process is not just to provide outcomes that, are guaranteeing sustainability, but that they're also having outcomes of specific trail uses. So I think this second round of trail planning, which will not take as long as the first round of trail planning, is going to get more to the outcome that I think you're looking for.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. I'm glad to hear you working on that. I like to hear that there are going to be miles of trails. Part of what I think is happening in some areas where the public is more supportive of ATV use and trails is that, you know, a logger comes in and makes a road into his timber sale, and you know, isn't there some way that for a while afterwards that could be just more of an informal trail? And I would encourage you to continue to look at that. The most important question that I had, it really deals with water in the state, and as your discussion has been so far this afternoon, water is extremely important in Minnesota. I mean, this is the land of 10,000 lakes, and you know, we have a number of issues dealing with our lakes and rivers. The concern that I have, and I know you didn't start this, but this was completed on, or finished under your administration, was the rolling of the division of waters into the ecosystems. And when there was a division of waters that was specifically designated for dealing with water issues in the state of Minnesota, I thought that was appropriate because of the importance of water. And I thought that at that point you had true water professionals on the job dealing with water issues in the state of Minnesota. Now we've rolled that into eco-services, and my thought is, you know, we've got drinking issues and recreational issues and mining issues and agriculture issues and other usage issues. And really, kind of the largest issue at this point for some of the folks who represent areas in the Red River Valley is the flood control issues. And so who in the department is kind of taking water management as their key focus, so that permitting and projects and that sort of stuff moves forward in within the DNR?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have to acknowledge that when I was outside the department when the merger was initially proposed, I didn't see how it could work. It didn't make any sense to me that these two should be merged, even though ultimately they're all part of the department. I mean, it's you know, it's splitters and joiners, I guess, is a perennial issue. But I've been assured, especially from staff, that they feel that this merger has been successful. And it doesn't mean that we have lost water professionals. It just means that they have a different reporting hierarchy. So we still have hydrologists. We still have ecologists. We don't try to mush them together and get a hydroecologist or something like that. So we still have that same hydrological expertise in the division. It just is now that they have a little bit of a different reporting strategy. Now, having said that, I'll also offer that, you know, that division, along with our Division of Forestry and our Division of Parks and Trails, are ones that are general funded. And so, you know, when we've gotten the general fund reductions, that's one that's gotten pinched. And so we are making reductions in staffing. It's not a result of the merger of the two divisions, I would offer. It's more just a reality of the new normal with respect to funding. So I think we still have that capacity of water experts, hydrologists. The deputy director, as you may know, for the Division of Ecological Water Resources is himself a hydrologist. And we still have the technical expertise we had previously with Kent Lacasmo, and I know you know Kent well, who has been working, continues to work on Red River flood damage reduction projects. And even Mike Carroll, who's now an assistant commissioner, has got some experience there. So we know that the Red River watershed is a huge resource issue in Minnesota, that there's ongoing need for investment there as well as for water planning. We still have much of what we need for that, but I will certainly acknowledge that we could do more, but we're funding limited. So I don't think that the merger in and of itself is cause for any loss of capacity there.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair, and then I'll be done. I appreciate those comments, Commissioner. I'm glad that you're aware of that as an issue. Just from my history, I always felt that a lot of times the debate within the department is just as strong and conflict-loaded as the debate that occurs outside of the department. And when you had an equal division head arguing positions from an equal level, sometimes the result was more of a compromise because they were arguing as equals. And I'd like to hope that you would make sure that debate and discussion is level and fair and resulting in the best outcome for water use in Minnesota.
Thank you for that. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, at the end of the day, you know, the buck stops here. And so we have the same discussions in the department because they represent many interests, as you all have here at the Capitol. And I think that discussion, that debate is great. At the end of the day, you know, everybody reports to me, and they that's why I believe it's very important they understand where I'm coming from and why that I'm espousing the notion of conservation that works, because conservation has to work for Minnesotans.
Thank you. Senator Peterson, and then Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Landwehr, I'm guessing that your office is getting the same context. We are, as the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, relating to the timberwolf population. Would you support a hunting season on the timberwolves this fall in 2012?
Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we've already gone on record as supporting it. In fact, we'll be putting forward a proposal for a season, I believe, on Thursday. Mr. Chairman, I think you're hearing some of the wolves.
So, quick follow-up. Have you had that discussion with the governor, and does he support that as well? Or?
Commissioner.
Mr. Commissioner, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, he does.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for coming. I think that we've seen a real dedication on your part throughout this first year, and appreciate your service. Certainly, your command of the issues is phenomenal, and so I thank you for your professionalism. My concern is with the forests. We have a lot of those up in my neck of the woods. And so I do have some concerns that we have a pun intended. Pun intended. We have a number of sawmills that are crying for pine. So I have a number of questions, and I don't know if you would want to, if I don't know if maybe the commissioner wants to expound more on forest management, and maybe that would answer some questions rather than what would you feel more comfortable with, Commissioner?
I could surely do that.
Commissioner, just real quickly, if you could, yeah, certainly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I hate to be between the only thing standing between you and a happy hour,
Mr. Nobles is here, and we've turned him away once already, and we don't want to do that again.
Just to reiterate, you know, we recognize that not only is the forest industry critical for Minnesota, it's critical for our forests and it's critical for our work. So we do want to make sure that we have a good relationship with industry and a sustainable view of forestry in the state of Minnesota. We are currently working on at least three different policy initiatives with respect to forestry so that we can be a better provider of timber. One of them is with respect to what we call extended rotation forestry. Extended rotation forestry is a way that we can provide older timber in a forest to meet some of the biological diversity needs and wildlife needs in our whole package of what we provide in a forest. Extended rotation forestry has been in place for a while now, but there are some that believe that it is not, it is creating more than what it is intended to. So we have started a process right now to investigate our extended rotation forest policy, refine that so that at the new implementation, it will give us what we want without overly penalizing timber harvest. That's one, is our extended rotation forestry initiative. Two is we are going in, starting in June, with what we call our subsection forest management, forest resource management plans, SFRMPs, that sets up, at the beginning, it sets up a perspective of what we want the forest in any particular state, part of the state to look like. We divide the state up into a number of regions, look in that region, say, okay, in this part of the state where we have this species composition, we want such and such an age structure and such a species composition. What do we do to get there? So it sets up a process that we have a vision of what we're going to be managing towards, and in that also then specifies what our harvest levels will be. So that going into that SFRMP process, especially with the new ERF, and I apologize for the acronyms, is going to give us, I believe, a better handle on the products that we can be providing to the timber industry. And the third thing that we're launching is a revision of MS-90. MS-90 is the statutes that guide timber sales in the state. We're doing timber sales today the same way we have done timber sales for 50 years. And maybe that's the right way to do it, but we think we need to take a look at that and say, you know, again, with a diminishing workforce, with a global industry out there, should we be doing it differently? And if so, what statutory changes we need to make? So that's a third initiative we've got going on. Just by way of example, one of the, you know, the traditional way of selling trees is we have a forester go out and mark trees, mark a timber sale, put it up for bid. The forester oversees the harvest of it. There is a different model out there called Logger Select, where you tell a forester, we want this, or you tell a logger, excuse me, that we want this woods to look like this when you're done. You go out, take care of it. And there, you know, it requires that there be a logger education program, which we have in Minnesota. It requires that there be certain standards that they have to agree to when they're done. But when we do that, it reduces the amount of time that we have to spend out marking timber and scaling timber and a whole ball of wax. So we're investigating, you know, how to apply that in a larger framework than what we are right now. Currently, about 14% of our sales are going to Logger Select, so we're making some progress there. It's going to give us some efficiencies, but there may be some statutory changes that are needed. So those three policy things we think are going to help our relationship with the forest products industry.
Follow up?
Okay, so thank you. If I understand correctly, is there any thought in the forestry division to model after what some of the counties are doing with their forest management in terms of managing by the acre as opposed to by the cord? In other words, it takes a lot less boots on the ground for the counties to go out and say, this is what we want this to look like. And I see in your initiative number two, you're going to want this forest in this area to look like this, and we can manage that by the acre as opposed to by the cord, and then use some of the techniques of the MS-90 that you're discovering, Logger Select and that. Is there any thoughts about how we could do that more efficiently and do with less boots on the ground, perhaps because of the budget considerations?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that is absolutely on the table in terms of discussion. One of the things that we realized when we were visiting with, I believe it was SAPI last week, is industry talks about tons. They don't talk about cords or acres. They talk about tons, and we're not there at all, and probably should be. So I think the way that we look at timber, the way that we market timber, the way that we sell timber, I think all of that is fair game to refinement.
And I promise I'll be brief because I know we need Mr. Nobles to get on. On the extended rotation forestry, we've gone in some cases on some woods from a 15% all the way up to over 52%. I guess it would be my hope that we can rein that back in and get the lumber to the sawmills, because I was very intent on making sure that the mills had a market. I said, you know, I said, if we're going to ask the Forest Service in Minnesota to provide more wood, you know, get beyond 800,000 cords up to 1 million cords, can you use it? And he said, oh my gosh, yes. He said, we're going to Wisconsin, we're going 200, 300 miles to get wood. He said, and you can imagine how cost prohibitive that is. So I hope that they're working that way. Finally, just the last question is in expediting. I know in 2008 we had some language that was put in statute to expedite land exchanges between counties and the state. I guess my concern would be, it doesn't appear that that's moving as quickly as possible. I don't know if that's a county's fault, a state's fault, or a statute's fault, but it just seems like when we have very apparent equal value of land, to try to get these small parcels moved so that the state has their parcels here, the county has their parcels here, so we can manage them more efficiently. What could we do? What can we help you with statutorily to make that happen more efficiently and way more cost effectively?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's no doubt in my mind that the process for moving state land is extraordinarily complicated and time-consuming, and I don't know specifically what happened in 2008, but we're engaging in a project that we call Strategic Land Asset Management. We piloted it in Roseau County. We're now going to be moving to a number of other counties where we actually sit down with the county land commissioner and look at the plat book and say, here's the state land, here's the county land. We could bring in the feds or maybe even the tribes if they own land and say, you know what, this doesn't make any sense. This pattern of ownership doesn't make any sense. And if you swap this and we swap that and we move these pieces around, we would both have an easier job managing land. So we did that with Roseau County. I think we came out with a product that Roseau County is very pleased with. And we actually had the very first land exchange this summer. It had to be approved by the executive council still. And it was small. It was 80 acres, but it was the very first time that we actually followed that procedure from that planning stage down to that implementation stage. I don't know. We want to continue with Roseau County and keep doing those transactions. I don't know if that means that at the end of the day we need to do tract by tract or if we can do a basket, which is really truly where I would like to get. If we know that we've got 10,000 acres that we'd like to swap with the county for 10,000 acres, we know the values are approximately equal, can we do that kind of a swap? If our administrative process does not foster that, does not allow that in a timely manner, I would propose to come to you and say, give us a legislative exchange so that we can bypass some of this administrative process, because it is just killing us, the amount of time that it takes to go through these kinds of exchanges.
Thank you. Senator Kielash.
Yeah, Commissioner, one of the things that you've brought up several times is not having enough funding. And one of the things that the people in Minnesota have done is they voted to tax themselves for outdoor heritage. And I know that there's kind of a tense relationship between the outdoor heritage councils and the DNR in some cases as to who should be managing it or how well the DNR manages it. Well, I'd like to get a little of your insight into how we can manage these funds for some of the very problems that you're talking about. I think, if, for example, trying to solve the invasive species is an ideal use of outdoor heritage funds because that's trying to stop them from lakes or whatever, and it just seems to make a lot of sense, especially if we're talking about trying to develop these new with the research eradications and or management of that. Can you just talk about the relationship with that, and you know, could the DNR use some more of that funding, and how would they use it? I guess is probably the follow-up on all of that. So,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I could digress for a minute, I want to go back a little bit to the, you know, what precipitated the creation of the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the statutory framework around it. The voters approved the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund back in, I believe it was 1994, and it was very shortly thereafter that instead of a dollar of that trust fund going into Environment and Natural Resources purposes, 40 cents went in there. And you know where the other 60 cents goes? It goes in the general fund. So there was a when it was created, there was a Greater Minnesota Fund and there was an Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. And a lot of people who supported that felt betrayed because the Greater Minnesota Corp part went away and now it goes in the general fund. And so people buy a lottery ticket. They think they're contributing a dollar to the trust fund. They're not. They're contributing some 40% of whatever the proceeds are. So part of this, the motivation for the promoters of the new legacy amendment was that we're going to put enough hardware on this that same thing can't happen. So now it is constitutional that it shall not substitute, that it lands acquired shall be open to hunting and fishing, and you know all of these other things that were intended to boilerplate that a little bit. Additionally, the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council was created in statute at the same time the amendment was passed by the legislature to ensure that there was a process to recommend funding for those dollars. So purpose in pointing that out is that I don't believe there's tension between the department and the Outdoor Heritage Council. I think this is just a standard resource allocation process where, you know, the folks that are recommending the money have some ideas and the folks that are requesting the money have other ideas. I think that the concern is that, as was indicated with the Environment Natural Resources Trust Fund, that it's very easy to divert those funds into purposes that perhaps voters didn't intend or purposes that are supplanting and not supplementing. So I think the advocates for the legacy funding and I think the council are very careful when they identify the types of projects that they want to fund to make sure that they're not supplanting, to make sure that they're fulfilling what they think the voters intended when they voted for those funds, and to make sure that the projects, the programs get funded have clear and identifiable outcomes. So that, in my mind, that's the framework around with which we operate. Now, the department is no different with respect to outdoor heritage funds than anybody else, Ducks Unlimited, Nature Conservancy, in terms of how we would acquire those funds. We still submit a proposal to the Outdoor Heritage Council. They consider it. They debate the merits relative to the other projects, and they recommend funding. We submitted 12 proposals this last rounding funding round. We got recommended for 5, so we don't have 100% success rate, and we don't expect to. We put in more projects than there are dollars available to allow the council to pick those that are good. I think our control on that is that we want to make sure the projects we put forward are truly legacy projects, things that after 25 years of voters of Minnesota will look at that and say, yes, DNR did right by their project. So we're going to put, you know, a subset of everything we do in a project proposal, not just everything we do, because we don't believe everything we do fits that framework. So I think, you know, my own feeling is that the process for legacy funds right now works quite well. I'd offer that the and you can hear from the legislative auditor Nobles very soon on program recommendations, but the clean water funds are done differently. Outdoor heritage funds go through this Outdoor Heritage Council process. Most of the clean water funds are appropriated to the agencies just legislatively. And I think that's appropriate because I think the Clean Water Legacy program, which was created by the legislature, you know, several years ago, had in mind a specific outcome, and that is to have, you know, clean water, reduce impairments over time by virtue of monitoring, you know, improvements and TMDLs and whole ball of wax. So there are different purposes and different processes, and I do think that's appropriate. I think the council is looking at Sarsam's Outdoor Heritage Council is looking at one of our proposals for funding is an invasive species request. They recommended $3 million for a carp barrier to reduce the silver carp, spread of silver carp. So they are taking on some of those invasive species issues. I said a lot. I don't know if I answered your question, Senator. Yes.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Saxlock.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment regarding the exchange between Senator Carlson and Commissioner Landwehr, and it involves exchanges. And they're both right that exchanges is very important for the management of our forest, but I remind everybody that the Esser Steel project, which is taking place in the last 10 years up on the range, but 4 years ago, the largest land exchange in the history of the state of Minnesota took place up there between the Blanham Paper Company and Itasca County. But, of course, because county lands are held in trust by the state of Minnesota participated too. So 7,000 acres, and it wasn't all, it wasn't two chunks. It was multi tracts of land. And it was done efficiently and made it possible for that great mining project to happen. So we're coming along.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Before I think Senator Dames has a motion, Commissioner, I'd just like to comment with regards to the public servant issue in the state of Minnesota, if I could, and I trust that you're working on that. In fact, I know you are. You and the governor have committed to doing that, and specifically in the northwest portion of the state. You mentioned that earlier, but I should expound on that a little bit of what good outreach I think that has been going on since you've taken over with the folks up in that area from Kitson, Rose, O'Marshall, in that area. And I think there's a good start. There's a lot of things yet to do, and so often we hear about the bureaucrats and how they're just going ahead and doing what they want. And I trust that you will work with us should you be confirmed over the next couple of years to make that a better attitude, and I really commend you for what you're doing, as well as the governor, with regards to that, and that outreach has been great, I think. But again, we've got some years or some things to do there yet, but nevertheless, I really appreciate that. And that's a small part of the world. There's not a lot of numbers there, but that kind of thing says an awful lot, I think, about how you feel about that, and I really appreciate that. So. I don't need any further comments than that. Senator Dames, did you have a motion?
Mr. Chair and members, I move the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee recommend the confirmation of Thomas Landwehr as a commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Okay, members, there's a motion. At this point in time, I will ask the members of the audience if they have any comments that they would like to make with regards to the to this motion. Seeing none, no further discussion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. It's carried. Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for your confidence and trust. I hope to make you very pleased.
Very good. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
I noticed how careful you were around the legislative auditor as well with that last question.
Well, I think the world up, by the way.
Yeah. Well, he's got it all covered. He's got it all covered. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor. And with me at the table is Cecile Ferkel, who's deputy legislative auditor for the Financial Audit Division, and Judy Randall, who is the manager of the program evaluation that we released recently on the legacy amendment. First, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I would just like to say congratulations to Commissioner Landwehr for the action that was taken here. Over the years, I've dealt with many commissioners of DNR, and I always say to them the same thing, and that is that they have probably one of the most important and one of the most challenging jobs in state government. And every one of them always says back, and yes, Jim, one of the things that makes it particularly challenging is dealing with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So. But we do have, already from the beginning, a very good relationship with Commissioner Landwehr. And we're going to be in that department a fair amount, as we have been in the past, but probably even more so in the future because of the legacy amendment. The legacy amendment, I think we would all agree, presented the state of Minnesota with a lot of opportunity, responsibility, and challenges. The opportunity is, of course, to provide more money to programs and activities that the people of the state say are very important to them, so important that they were willing to raise taxes to put more money into those programs and activities. But the amendment also presented us with responsibilities. You and all of us, really, we have to make sure that we do use the money effectively, use it consistently with the constitutional provisions and with the will of the people. And that's going to be a great challenge. One of the challenges also for the agencies is that administering dedicated money, particularly constitutionally dedicated money, is not always easy because there are a lot of strings attached, both from the constitutional provisions and from the statutory provisions. And that's where we come in. We're the auditors of state government, and we go into the organizations of state government that you appropriate money to. And our job is to ensure that they are using it consistently with the statutes, and in this case, with the Constitution. And so we have made our first venture into that new responsibility for us. We issued two reports in November of last year. One of them, a financial audit, is the very traditional digging deep into the details. And you have that report. We will only briefly summarize it, but certainly would comment on any questions that you might have. What I think we might want to do with the limited time we have is have Judy Randall give you a brief overview. And that's really what was intended with this evaluation, is to give you, in a sense, a primer on the way the legacy amendment has been implemented. And there are some real complexities to it in terms of the structure and process, some of which Commissioner Landwehr already laid out. And we needed to make an assessment of whether or not that structure early on is working, whether it needs modification. And we also address some of the more sensitive issues that have already come up in terms of conflict of interest, in terms of are we setting the right goals and meeting those goals for this important legacy money. So, Mr. Chairman, without further comments from me at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Randall to give you an overview.
Ms. Randall, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Judy Randall. I am an evaluation manager with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Let me just jump right in and provide just a quick overview on the legacy amendment. I would imagine this is a refresher for all of you, but just to make sure we're on the same page, in 2008, Minnesota voters passed the constitutional amendment. It raised the state sales tax by 0.3% and dedicated that money for specific purposes. It's projected to raise between $240 and $300 million annually, and, of course, it lasts for 25 years. So if you do the math, it's expected to raise between $6 and $7.5 billion over the course of the 25 years. So we're talking a significant amount of money. The legacy amendment, in addition to raising that state sales tax, established four funds: the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the Clean Water Fund, the Parks and Trails Fund, and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. It also designated what percentage of that raised revenue would go to each of those funds. So you can see the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Clean Water Fund each receive a third of that revenue, and then the remaining third is split, although you'll see not evenly, among the Parks and Trails Fund and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. And then finally, the amendment establishes the purposes for which money dedicated to each of those funds can be used. So for the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the purpose in the Constitution now is to restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. The Clean Water Fund is focused on protecting, enhancing, and restoring surface water, groundwater, drinking water. The Parks and Trails Fund is focused on supporting the parks and trails system, parks and trails of regional or statewide significance. Then the purpose for the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund is probably the broadest. It includes arts, arts education, arts access, and preserving Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. So that's just a quick reminder of what happened when the legacy amendment was passed. Now I just want to quickly walk through how the legacy money is appropriated and how it flows through the system. This is a kind of a complicated slide. It's recreated on page 43 of the report in front of you. Might be easier to follow there. It's up to you. Again, that was page 43. So first, the sales tax revenue is generated. It was approximately $250 million in fiscal year 2011. The money comes into the state treasury and then goes out to the four funds that, again, were established in the amendment. Again, a third of the money goes to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, a third to Clean Water Fund, and then again, the remaining third divided among the other two funds. Up to here, they're all the same. But now this is when the differences start to come into play, and this is important, I think, to understand, and we spend some time in the report discussing these differences. So kind of the big difference that jumps out is the existence of advisory councils. Both the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Clean Water Fund have advisory councils that are established in statute. And then you can see the Parks and Trails Fund and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund do not have permanent ongoing advisory councils that are established in law. So I want to just spend a little bit of time here talking about these differences. Let's start first with the two that have the advisory councils. So Outdoor Heritage Fund, Clean Water Fund, both have advisory councils, but the advisory councils are pretty different, as you probably already know. So the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, as the commissioner mentioned, was created in anticipation of the legacy amendment being passed. It was created for the Outdoor Heritage Fund specifically. It's created in the legislative branch. There are 12 voting members, four of whom are legislators. And the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council has a pretty rigorous process that it goes through to evaluate proposals to receive Outdoor Heritage Fund money. They put out a bid for requests. They receive proposals from state agencies and from nonprofit organizations. They review the requests. The members then rank them and score them individually. And then together, the Lessard-Sams Council puts together an appropriations recommendations package that it then must present back to the legislature by January 15th of each year. The Clean Water Council is pretty different. First of all, it predates the Legacy Amendment. It was established in 2006 as part of the Clean Water Legacy Act. It's established in the executive branch. There are 19 members, none of whom are legislators. There are four non-voting legislators on the Clean Water Council, as well as five non-voting agency representatives. The Clean Water Council makes kind of broad programmatic suggestions and priorities related to the Clean Water Fund, but it doesn't recommend specific projects in the way the Lessard-Sams Council does. Again, it works closely with the state agencies. And in 2011, actually, was the first time it was given the specific responsibility in law to make recommendations to the legislature regarding appropriations from the Clean Water Fund. So, again, these two advisory councils are pretty different. Then when you move to the other two funds, there are not existing ongoing advisory councils established in law. Parks and Trails Fund, as you know, the funding has largely been allocated kind of on a formulaic basis. The money's been divided among three different areas of interest: state parks, regional parks in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and then regional parks in outstate Minnesota. And that money has largely been allocated kind of on a formulaic basis. In 2011, the legislature did require the commissioner to establish an ad hoc advisory committee to help determine the formula for distribution. But again, it's a different type of advisory committee and not an ongoing one established in law. The commissioner has established his own advisory committee that he's gotten up and running this past summer he started. But again, it's a different type of advisory council, again, not in law, not established permanently. And then the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund doesn't have an advisory council, and frankly, it maybe would be difficult to have one advisory council fully represent all the disparate interests that are involved with the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Instead, as you probably well know, different organizations and interest groups that are interested in having the fund support their activities come directly to the legislature, work either with you or other members, and kind of put forth specific bills specifically for their interests. So the legislature, as you know, takes in all this information. It takes the information from the two advisory councils and then directly also from stakeholders. You all work your magic, and then you appropriate the legacy money back out to the state agencies. I've listed here the agencies that were kind of the primary recipients of legacy funding in 2011, DNR, PCA, Bowser, the State Arts Board, the Historical Society, the Department of Ag, the Department of Health. There were about 13 to 15 state agencies that received legacy funding in fiscal year 2011. And then the state agencies ultimately allocate the money out to the ultimate recipients. Oftentimes, the agencies themselves are the ultimate recipients, but they also then will allocate it out to other nonprofit organizations or NGOs. Important to note that even if a specific organization is named in law to receive legacy money, that money first must flow through a state agency that acts as the fiscal agent for those funds. All right, so that was kind of messy and kind of long, but I think it's important to understand the differences for these four funds. So kind of the key differences we see, the existence of an advisory group or not, and again, the different nature of the two advisory groups that do exist. How the money is allocated. Again, you know, Parks and Trails Fund, it was allocated really kind of on a formulaic basis. Compare that to the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council and the Outdoor Heritage Fund money, which is allocated really through a competitive, comprehensive review process each year. Finally, there's differences in oversight. The Lessard-Sams Council also provides ongoing oversight throughout the year, where they're making sure the money that's being spent is being spent according to accomplishment plans that are put in place. It's pretty different than the Clean Water Council, which does not provide ongoing oversight of the expenditures. Instead, the Clean Water Council relies on the state agencies that are serving as fiscal agents to oversee the expenditure of the Clean Water Fund money. So when we were working on this and we saw these differences in structure and process, we thought to ourselves, well, you know, does this make sense? Should every fund have an advisory council? Should none of the funds have an advisory council? Should they all be the same? Is it okay that they're different? And ultimately, what we kind of came to is that these differences are there for a reason. They reflect the history and the purposes and the different constituencies of the four funds. So just to run through that quickly, you know, the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council represents very active interest groups that were involved from the get-go in helping the legacy amendment get put through. They had lots of ideas on how that Outdoor Heritage Fund money should be spent, and the Outdoor Heritage Council kind of gives that group a seat at the table, literally and figuratively. The Clean Water Council predated the legacy amendment, and the legislature saw that this group already existed, had expertise related to clean water issues. You know, maybe it made sense to leverage that existing process, existing system, existing expertise. Same is true for Parks and Trails. DNR and Met Council already had, you know, existing processes in place to prioritize park and trail investments. Again, made sense to leverage existing systems. And then the Minnesota Arts Board and Historical Society for the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund had existing grants processes in place. And importantly, they had reached to all four corners of the state, or to all areas of the state. So it made sense to use those existing systems and those organizations to allocate and help distribute large chunks of the Cultural Heritage Fund money. So in the end, I think what we're trying to convey is that we accept these differences and think that it can work well with these different structures. So, but despite these differences, we did find some kind of ongoing concerns that affect all four funds. So these are some common concerns across the funds that stand regardless of the differences in the structures that are in place. So I'll touch on those real quickly. I know I'm talking really fast. I'm trying to get you out of here as soon as you can. So if you need me to slow down, you know, signal me. But let's just go through these ongoing concerns real quickly. So the first one, and I'll spend a little more time on each of these, is to is whether or not we're achieving the desired outcomes with the legacy money. Are we getting what the voters thought they were voting for when they voted for it? The next one is regarding the supplement, not substitute requirement. You heard the commissioner allude to that. There's concerns that that agencies and perhaps the legislature are, you know, there's concern about complying with this requirement and how can we better comply with it. There's concerns about conflicts of interest, the extent to which they exist, the extent to which they're mitigated, and then there's concerns about complying with the requirements related to administrative expenses. So let me take each one of those quickly. So the first one is whether or not we're getting what we intended with the money, and are we achieving what, again, what the voters were hoping to get out of this. So for each of the funds, there's kind of a different concern out there. So first, related to the Outdoor Heritage Fund. With the Outdoor Heritage Fund, we are purchasing public land. And as the discussion before us touched on, you know, there's already concerns to some extent that the state maybe already has a lot of public land, and maybe the state has trouble managing all of the public land it already owns. And so is it appropriate, is it the best use of the Outdoor Heritage Fund money to purchase additional land? Does the state have the resources to manage that? And there's a lot of complications related to it. Related to the Clean Water Fund, there's concerns that we're not using the money to produce measurable results, that we're doing a lot of testing and monitoring, but not perhaps enough cleaning up polluted land or preventing cleaning up polluted water or preventing additional water from getting polluted. And so, you know, again, are we getting the results that we intended? Related to the Parks and Trails Fund, there's concerns that the money is being used simply to support the existing Parks and Trails system rather than using the money to enhance the system or to do, you know, more new supplemental things rather than just, again, taking care of the existing system. Finally, related to the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, there are questions out there that we're using the money for projects of marginal significance, and that especially in a time of tighter budgets, you know, are these the priorities that the state wants to fund? So these are concerns that are out there. We don't have recommendations related to them. It's more just an airing of things that people are talking about and things that the legislature, frankly, is probably going to have to keep struggling with over the life of this amendment. Next ongoing concern is related to the supplement, not substitute provision. And this, again, was one that came up earlier. I just want to get to where I am in my notes. So let me just remind you of what the Constitution requires, which is the amendment requires the legacy funds to supplement and not substitute for, quote-unquote, traditional sources of funding. But there's a lot of confusion about what compliance with this requirement means or what it looks like. In particular, what constitutes a traditional source of funding? If an activity started, let's say, last year and was funded with general fund money, well, does that mean now that's traditional source of funding for that activity and that activity can never be funded with legacy money? What if it was funded for 10 years with general fund money? What if it was funded with federal funds or with nonprofit funds? So, I mean, you can see that, you know, as you get into this, there's actually a lot of questions about what the language in the amendment really means. What is a traditional source of funding? Over the summer, a group of, I think, 30 environmental groups wrote a letter to the governor and legislative leaders kind of suggesting what they thought compliance with this provision would look like. And they said, if the legislature allocates 1% of the general fund, which is kind of a historically low number, but a historic number from the general fund, if the legislature allocated 1% of general fund money to the great outdoors, purposes of the great outdoors, then that would be compliance with this requirement, and we wouldn't be substituting legacy money for traditional sources of funding. And we talked about that proposal a lot in our office. We thought about it, and ultimately we rejected that line of thought for a couple of reasons. One is that the amendment, the Constitution, doesn't require maintaining a traditional level of funding. It simply talks about traditional sources, not traditional levels of funding. But even more than that, we think the Constitution doesn't, the language in the Constitution doesn't say that the legislature, I want to think about how I want to say this. The language in the Constitution doesn't take away from the legislature its responsibility to establish spending priorities each year and to look at what the needs of the state are and establish those spending priorities and make those spending decisions. So as a result, we didn't buy the kind of 1% of the general fund must always go to outdoor purposes. We just didn't think that was supported by the language in the Constitution. Nevertheless, we do have some recommendations regarding this provision. The first is to the legislature. We recommend that the legislature establish a process kind of somewhat similar to a fiscal note process, where if a project comes forward that's being proposed to be funded with legacy money, the bill author or the committee chair could ask for information on the historical funding for that activity. You know, so I come forward with a proposal saying I want legacy fund money for XYZ. You all could say, okay, well, let's see the historical funding for Project XYZ. What was the traditional sources of funding before? How are those changing? Why are you coming now for legacy fund money? The purpose of the process wouldn't be for enforcement or for compliance, but it would be kind of another mechanism of information and a way for the legislature to demonstrate due diligence and serious consideration of this provision. We also recommend more generally to state agencies and legacy fund recipients that they document how they are complying with this requirement. I think at the end of the day, even if it's kind of confusing and vague about what's required, I just got the not-so-subtle watch next to me, sorry. even if it's not clear what's required, it's important that everybody show due diligence and serious consideration of these provisions. I don't think I can talk much faster, but I'm going really quickly. Conflict of interest concerns, we think, are going to be a persistent concern. This is our third ongoing concern. And we think this one's going to persist throughout the life of the amendment. One thing that makes this really complicated is that there are lots of different opinions about what a conflict of interest is. Making it even more complicated is that there are different conflict of interest laws and policies depending on which fund we're talking about, specific facts of people's relationships. So what we think is really important is that each fund and each organization that's involved with legacy funds have a process in place to address conflicts of interest, to mitigate them should they exist. And for the most part, as we talked to different organizations and agencies, people were taking this very seriously and doing a good job. The one exception was the Clean Water Council, which was the only organization that hadn't really paid significantly close attention to conflict of interest concerns. So our recommendations, not surprisingly, the first one is to the Clean Water Council to develop conflict of interest policies and procedures. I will note we made this presentation to the Clean Water Council in December, and I know that they are already working on this recommendation and putting together some conflict of interest policies and procedures. And then finally, just more generally to everybody involved in the legacy amendment, conflict of interest is a serious concern. It's not going to go away over the course of the legacy amendment, so everybody kind of just needs to keep it high on the radar screen and pay significant attention to it. Lastly, the last ongoing concern is related to administrative expenses. And there's a lot of confusion out there among agencies on how to comply with the requirements that are in law. So the current law right now requires administrative expenses to be directly related to and necessary for legacy-funded activity. For three of the four funds, this was a change that was made by the 2011 legislature. Prior to that, it was more like a percentage cap. So $100,000 of legacy money is allocated to an agency, and they can use, in the law, it would say, you know, up to 1% or up to 3.5% or whatever percentage you all put in law for administrative expenses. That got changed in 2011 so that now this directly related to and necessary for language is in place. It gives a lot more discretion to state agencies. It also gives them more responsibility in demonstrating the link between their expenses and the legacy fund activity. We heard from some agencies that wanted to use their indirect cost allocation rate. Kind of when they typically get money into their agency, they would take a standard 1% and use that money for human resources or IT. They wanted to be able to apply that same cost rate to the legacy money. Some agencies complained about the burden that this language puts on them. You know, it's more reporting and more accounting for them to keep track of all of their administrative expenses and to be able to delineate clearly the link to the legacy funded activity. And, you know, we're sympathetic to that. It is more reporting and it is more accounting for them. But ultimately, the way we looked at it is, you know, there are strings attached to the constitutionally dedicated money, and that's one of them. And it's, at the end of the day, that's the cost of receiving the legacy fund money. So we did have some recommendations, though. First is that the agencies and all legacy fund recipients need to document how they're complying with the requirement about regarding administrative expenses. Again, yeah, it's a little more work for them, but at the end of the day, it's what's required in law, and we think it's important. We also make a recommendation to the Department of Management and Budget to provide some leadership to state agencies about how to think through these administrative expense requirements and how they can comply with it. Last session, you all required MMB to provide some guidance to state agencies on accounting for legacy funds. So this recommendation really just kind of builds on that and asks MMB to provide some more leadership to agencies about thinking through this process. The financial audit our office did dug a lot deeper into these administrative expenses. So I'm going to throw it over to Ms. Ferkel if we have time for her to briefly cover the financial audit findings. Or no, I'm getting waved off. Mr. Chair, I think we're open for questions.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to comment on the administrative expenses just to, and again, you have the report. But it really is one of the complications and challenges, as Ms. Randall said. But we think it is important that agencies do as much as they possibly can to use this legacy money for what we've often called boots on the ground, the projects out in the field that need to get done, and not soak up any more legacy money than is absolutely necessary for the internal administrative functions. But it is a challenge because, as you well know, some of that money for those administrative functions that have traditionally been there have been reduced, if not taken away. So agencies are in a real crunch over that issue, but it's an important one, I think, for us all to maintain accountability on that. Just one final clarification. I want to be clear that everybody understands that when we rejected the suggestion of environmental and conservation organizations that the state should maintain a 1% general fund support for the great outdoors, we were not criticizing the idea or that as a policy. We were simply saying that in our analysis, we could not find that that's what the constitutional amendment bound the legislature to. That's our position. But we certainly respect both the advocacy of the various organizations to put forth to you their policy recommendation that it should be at least 1%. And certainly your prerogative to do the 1% as a guiding policy or a guideline. But again, we simply could not find in the language or history of the legacy amendment that that is there to bind you as a legislature. A court could potentially find that, but has not to date. So we think you are left with the overall constitutional responsibility that you have to set priorities according to all of the money that comes into the Treasury. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kielash.
On the administrative expenses, you talk about agencies. Is that also NGOs and any other organizations that are getting that legacy fund dollars? And yep. Is that oversight?
Yes.
Do we need to have policies in place,
yes.
Specific policies?
Senator Kielash, thank you very much. It's a good question and something that I think everybody ought to be aware of, that a lot of the legacy money does go to nonprofit organizations. And it's clear that that requirement, that administrative costs have to be directly related to and necessary for the specific project that was appropriated with legacy money, has to be kept by them as well. And as the Office of the Legislative Auditor, we go into nonprofit organizations. We have that legal authority. They have to let us in the door. They have to show us their records. And as a part of the audit that we performed, we did go into a number of nonprofit organizations and looked at their books. It is, just like the supplement supplant issue, defining exactly what is an administrative expense and how directly related to and necessary for it has to be can be a challenge. It's somewhat of a subjective judgment. But I think the burden of proof has to be there on the recipient of the money to show us that their expenditure of legacy money for administrative costs complied with the constitutional requirements and the law.
Can I follow up on that?
Certainly.
And my other question would be, because all of this funding has to go through an agency and it is much of it is oversight, is there a policy or is there a employment type of consideration for people that are specifically doing oversight of the legacy fund dollars, whether it be in the DNR or the Arts Board or whatever, so that We actually have people with jobs whose responsibility is to do the oversight of it. May not be delivering the actual services, but they are responsible for the oversight. And are they able to is that agency able to capture funds for that?
Mr. Nobles.
Well, first of all, the point of emphasis that you make is certainly agencies that receive appropriations from you that are ultimately destined for a nonprofit. They have a fiscal agent responsibility of oversight and to do much of what we do when we go out and audit, and that is determine whether or not the funds have been used according to the constitutional provisions, the law, and the grant agreement, and that they have complied with any requirements for use of administrative expense, supplement, not substitute, that sort of thing. Have agencies specifically received positions for that level of oversight? My impression is not in any substantial degree. I think all of us in state government are faced with a situation, both in the Office of the Legislative Auditor and in the agencies, of taking on, frankly, a lot of added responsibilities under the Legacy Amendment for oversight and accountability that we are simply going to have to make a priority. We in the Office of the Legislative Auditor didn't get additional staff or funding to do this legacy audit work, but it is a very high priority to us. We think all public money deserves a high level of accountability. We think legacy money deserves an especially high level because it represents a vote of the people to increase their taxes for very specific purposes. And ultimately, it's our job and responsibility to ensure that we stay true to those expectations.
Can I follow?
Real quickly.
It's just my concern is as we're hacking away at state budget and personnel in many cases across these departments and agencies, that we are taking people that had work within that agency and putting them in charge of oversight. So the work that the state was paying them to do is no longer there. Plus, you keep adding the burden of the oversight. So, you know, isn't it appropriate if you've got this outside funding source that's going is a pass-through and still requires oversight that the agency at least have some kind of funding to make sure that they're not dropping the ball elsewhere in their agency to oversee this legacy fund dollars?
And, Mr. Chairman, and Senators all, I think that's something you should be concerned about as agencies come forth to you with their budgets. And I think we are all hoping for better days ahead in terms of the support that is needed to ensure a good administration of state government, including oversight of legacy funds. So I don't think you would get an argument from us that those are worthy dollars to spend in terms of ensuring accountability and oversight. But we also understand the budgetary situation we're in. And I don't think we can shirk our responsibility simply because money's tight. I think particularly with legacy money, we have to view this as a priority. And if we have to give up other things as lower priorities, I think that's the reality we face.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just to add to that point, Senator Kielash, I think when the money is allocated through an agency as a fiscal agent in a grant program, that the agency then does have kind of more ability to use some of those legacy dollars for its own administrative purposes of that grant program.
Okay.
Does that make sense? When it's legislatively named, you know, so when the ultimate recipient is named in law, and so there's not kind of a grant process that really a competitive process that the agency manages, it may be less clear how that agency can both have administrative dollars, you know, from the money. And then we've also seen in other reports that oftentimes when a recipient is legislatively named, there is less oversight by the fiscal agent, by the state agency.
And I think it should be noted the Outdoor Heritage Fund does actually hire people to administer some portions of that already. So, okay, I think in the interest of everybody wanting to move on here, I really appreciate your expediency, Ms. Randall, with that. And members, you've got a copy of the report in your file. Some of it, some of us have heard this before. If you have any questions,
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that we are very committed to providing the level of oversight and accountability that we can through the Office of the Legislative Auditor for legacy money, and we are very open to be responsive to the concerns that you have as we move along with this legacy amendment.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much for the report, and we're adjourned.
See you later.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Multiple cards.
No, I didn't expect it.
Most often.